Well, good morning. Open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 10, please, and we'll start there. 1 Samuel 10. We're glad you're here. Got a bunch of people here today. You know, when the front pews are full, it's a full house, and we got a full house this morning. We're glad for each and every one that are here. We love you. God loves you. We'd love to talk to you. If you have any questions about anything, please let me know or anybody who's a member here know. Be glad to sit and talk with you about that. You're catching us in the middle of our series, so I want to do the next installment this morning of our year-long series on biblical milestones. So last month we talked about Judges, number 5. Here we are in the last Sunday of June. We're talking about the kings of Israel. And so we're going to talk about them. Again, our goal in this series is not to try to summarize the events that happened during this period of time, but just to draw some lessons out of there that are relevant to us in the modern day that help us in our walk with Christ. So we want to do that as we consider the kings of Israel this morning. A lot to talk about there, and so I'm just going to make it simple and divide it into two parts. We're going to talk about the United Kingdom and the Divided Kingdom. So we'll start with the United Kingdom this morning. And the lesson I want to focus on with those guys is that even godly people can lose their way. We'll talk about Saul, David, and Solomon in that regard. All three of those men, Saul, David, and Solomon, started well. And David was pretty good throughout the whole thing, throughout his whole life. But each of them fell into terrible sin, and so their actions are preserved for us as a cautionary tale. Let's think about them. We're going to start with Saul here in 1 Samuel chapter 10. Saul was very humble. Do you remember when he's first being chosen, being anointed, being told, you're going to be the first king of Israel? And he's very unassuming. He's very humble. He's, you know, he don't want the attention. He's hiding. 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 22. Therefore, they inquired further, Lord, has the man come here yet? So the Lord said, behold, he's hiding himself by the baggage. And so they ran and took him from there. And when he stood before the people, among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? Surely there's no one like him among all the people. And so all the people shouted and said, long live the king. Okay, so here's Saul. And again, he's humble. He's almost reluctant to do this at first. He doesn't even tell his folks that, you know, I was chosen as the next. You know, he's just very kind of unassuming. That's how he starts. And everybody looks at him on this day, and of course, he's a big, tall, handsome guy, and everybody thinks, that's the king right there. That's our king. And he starts well. Everything's fine at first. But then it doesn't take long before Saul has this tendency to kind of disobey. In fact, look in chapter 13. In chapter 13, the Philistines have assembled for battle. And the Israelites are scared to death. A lot of them have gone and hidden in caves and places like that. And so Samuel had given instructions way back in 10 and verse 8, that apparently, which were standing instructions, when you assemble at Gilgal, wait 7 days for me to come, and then the sacrifice will be made. And so that's what they're doing. They're assembling at Gilgal, and that's where we pick up the stories. 1 Samuel 13 and verse 8. Now he waited 7 days, according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings, and he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. Okay, we got a problem. It says, it's interesting, he waited 7 days, but not the whole 7 days, and not until Samuel, the prophet, got there. And so Saul disobeyed. And that was Saul's problem. He had a tendency to do that. He would think, that's close enough. And so he's thinking, it's 7 days. I'm just going to go ahead and do it. I don't know where Samuel's at. And of course, as soon as he finishes, then Samuel shows up. So he doesn't fully obey. And that's his tendency. Saul says, you know, all these excuses. Look in verse 11 as we continue. Samuel said to him, what have you done? And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the appointed days and that the Philistines were assembling at Mishmash, therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I've not asked the favor of the Lord, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. Samuel said to Saul, you've acted foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. So we might look at this story and we think, I mean, he pretty much obeyed. It was the seventh day. He waited 7 days like he was supposed to. But God sees this as a problem. You didn't do exactly what I told you to do, And so I'm taking the kingdom away from you. That's the way God sees it here. And that was the punishment. And Saul has all the excuses that he lays out there. He says all of that stuff, but God is not impressed. And so that's the end of the story. You didn't wait the full 7 days. You didn't wait till Samuel comes. Period, end of story. Your kingdom shall not endure. That's the way God looked at it. In chapter 15, turn the page. Same thing again. Saul was told, destroy the Amalekites. Animals, everything. Nothing left alive. That's the command. But this is what he did. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 9. Samuel and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly. But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. Again, isn't that tendency? Close enough. We killed most of them. And so he doesn't obey God. And again, God sees that as a problem. In verse 28, Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. So there's our first king, Saul. He starts out good. He's humble. He's unassuming. But it's not long before he falls into that tendency of disobedience. So who's the one that's better than Saul? Well, that's David, who's anointed to be the next king. Look in 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel 11. David was a godly man. Just like Saul, David is handpicked by God himself. David had enough faith and courage as a young man to fight and conquer Goliath. So there's a lot of good things we can say about David. But David himself strayed into sin. Chapter 11 and verse 2. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And so he commits fornication with her. See, in chapter 12 and verse 9, here's what his prophet said to him. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You've struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword, have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with a sword of the sons of Ammon. Now, you know, as we're going through these stories, Saul, David, Solomon's going to be next. What we need to do is take this to heart, to be sincere and and not have this spiritual pride. It'll never happen to me. I'll never do that. Here were guys that were godly, especially David. This is a godly man. He's got a righteous legacy. In fact, at the end of the whole thing in the New Testament, as the New Testament's looking back to him, it remembers David in a righteous way, that he was overall a righteous man, has this spiritual legacy that follow him. He's mentioned in Hebrews 11, for example. And Jesus is referred to as the son of David. So David's a prominent figure in the physical lineage of Jesus. So the New Testament looks favorably upon David. He came back from his sin and he returned to God and he did what was right. And all that's good and wonderful. The day of Pentecost, remember, Peter is quoting from David to in part establish the legitimacy of Christ as Lord, or of Jesus as Christ and Lord. And so, good man, good man. And yet even David lost his way here for a bit. I hope none of us ever think it won't happen to me. It happened to David. It's happened to every single person on the planet who's accountable before God, except Jesus himself. The devil's good at what he does. Let's not have pride to think, not me. Solomon, the next one. David's son Solomon, when he reigns. Look in 1 Kings chapter 3. Solomon started out on the right foot. He's a good man. He's following God. He fears God. He's obeying the statutes like David. 1 Kings 3:3 says, here's one of the evidences of his maturity. 1 Kings 3 and verse 5. In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, ask what you wish me to give you. Now, if you want to see somebody mature or not, give them that option. I'll give you whatever you want. And then his response there is something that the Lord is pleased with. Verse 9, Solomon said, so give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who's able to judge this great people of yours? It was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And so because God is so happy with him, he not only gives him that understanding heart, that wisdom, but also riches and long life and prosperity and honor and all of that. And so he loads Solomon up. And so Solomon starts well. He asks for something like that. God blesses him with all those things. And it's good and it's wonderful. But what does Solomon end up doing with that bountiful life with which God has blessed him? He goes astray. Look in 1 Kings 11 and in verse 3. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. And so Solomon takes a wrong turn. And he goes way off the deep end. I mean, read Ecclesiastes and you can just see the striving for happiness, looking for and exploring every kind of worldly pursuit there is, looking for happiness under the sun. Solomon just went off the rail. And I know there's a couple of good verses at the conclusion, the last two verses of Ecclesiastes. I don't know if that meant Solomon personally applied that or not, if he came back to God. I don't know if he ever repented or not. It's one thing to say something, it's another thing to do it. So I know what he wrote. And so here's Solomon that went off the rails, and here was a man that started good, started wise. God blesses him with extra wisdom, extra honor, long life, all of this stuff, and yet he goes astray. So is there something we learn from this period of the United Kingdom? When we look back to these guys, each of them are king for 40 years. You got 120 years worth of history. Is there something we learn from Saul, David, and Solomon? Nobody, and I mean nobody, is immune to temptation. It can happen and has happened to all of us. You can start with the humility of Saul and the heart of David and the wisdom of Solomon and still go astray. None of us should be having this prideful attitude, well, it can happen to me. And by the way, young people, when your parents are warning you about some spiritually dangerous situation, please have enough wisdom and humility to listen to what they're saying to you. They know this, and they're trying to help you. Don't have that pride and say, Mom and Dad, it's not going to happen to me. I'll never do something bad like that. You might. You might. Because good people have done that before, and it's going to keep happening because the devil's very good at what he does. And that's not just a warning to young people. All of us at any age should never think, I'm not going to be tempted by that sin. I can do something dangerous. It's not going to affect me. Again, we read 1 Kings 11:4. What did it say? For when Solomon was what? Old. When Solomon was old, this happened. He goes astray. His wives turn his heart away. So make no mistake, the devil's very good at what he does. Again, except for Jesus, the devil's been successful at tempting every single person who's accountable before God to commit some sin. In the context of lust and sin, James wrote, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. James 1:16. Why would he say that? Do not be deceived. Apparently, it's because we can be deceived about it. Don't be deceived. We should not be naive and foolish about the dangers of temptation. The lion is hungry. Well, let's talk about the divided kingdom for a minute. Look in 1 Kings chapter 12. When we think about the divided kingdom, a lot of history, a whole bunch of kings through there, a lot we could pull from. Let me just draw one main lesson from the period of the divided kingdom. That is, your faith is your own choice. Okay, you got Saul, David, and Solomon. And then when Solomon dies, the kingdom divides. And so now you have not just the kingdom of Israel united, but now you have the northern kingdom called Israel and the southern kingdom called Judah. So we call this the period of the divided kingdom. And it's a time of sadness and sin, even more so than the United Kingdom, where people spiral and the nations spiral into sin very quickly. Judah in the south was mostly wicked. Most of their kings were wicked most of the time. And they spiral into sin. After about 350 years, God's had enough and he sends Judah into captivity. In the north, the kings of Israel are completely evil. Not mostly evil, they're completely evil. And it only takes them about 200 years before God runs out of patience with them and the northern kingdom of Israel goes into captivity. And so Jeroboam was the first king in the north in Israel. And that's why we're here in 1 Kings chapter 12. Just notice the legacy of sin that he began. 1 Kings 12:26. Then Jeroboam the son of Nebat and Ephraimite of Zeredah, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also rebelled against the king. I'm in the wrong chapter. 1 Kings 12, not 11. 12:26. Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the king consulted and made two golden calves, and he said to them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. He set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went up to worship before the one as far as Dan. And he made houses on high places and made priests from among all the people who were not the sons of Levi. Jeroboam instituted a feast in the eighth month on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah. And he went up to the altar, thus he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he had made. And he stationed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. Then he went up to the altar which had been made in Bethel on the 15th day in the eighth month, even in the month on which he had devised in his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel and went up to the altar to burn incense. Okay, so first thing he does is disobey God. Set up these idols, come up with feasts out of his own mind, and we're going to do our own thing and kick out the legitimate priests from the tribe of Levi, and we'll just make our own priests and all kinds of stuff. And so by doing that, one of the things he did was run off all the good people. 2 Chronicles 11 tells us. The good ones don't want to stay, and you're not going to be able to worship God in this nation. So they all leave, and they're gone. And then by setting up those idols and getting them started off on the wrong foot, it's easy then for the next generations to do the very same thing, to continue to worship those idols. So he sets up those two golden calves in Dan and Bethel, and then his son Nadab is the next king. What do you think Nadab does? Well, Nadab walked in the way of his father. And what do you think the next king does? He walked in the way of Jeroboam. And what do you think the next king did? Elah made Israel sin with their idols. And on it goes through the rest of the kings in that northern kingdom of Israel. All of them sin. All of them are following in the ways of Jeroboam. Shalom only reigned 1 month before he was assassinated. We don't have a statement like that about him. And then Hoshea was the king when they went into captivity. All of them follow in the way of Jeroboam. It was their fault. They could have changed it. But Jeroboam got them started off on that terrible legacy of idolatry, and every single one of them in the north followed suit. You've seen this chart before that I've put up, and I'm just trying to illustrate good and bad with red and green. So Saul, David, and Solomon up here, and then here's the northern kingdom of Israel. You notice all the red because they're just completely evil. None of them are trying to get back and serve God. And then on the right side, the southern kingdom of Judah has some green spots in there. So they had some good kings that were bright spots. Hezekiah and Josiah are standouts in there. Now, what can we learn as we look at that? Your faith is your own choice, or your lack of faith is your own choice. Because what we see here as we go back and forth, especially against fathers and sons, is there's some switching going on there. Let me just show you an example of what I'm talking about. We'll take a chunk of those kings there and look at several generations who served as kings. And I just want to illustrate the fact that you can have wicked parents and then decide to be righteous yourself, or you can have righteous parents and decide to be wicked yourself. And it's nowhere better illustrated in the Bible, I think, than what we have right here in the period of the divided kingdom. Look in 2 Kings now, chapter 16. Let me see if I can find the right chapter this time. 2 Kings chapter 16. And first you have Ahaz, verse 3. He walked in the way of the kings of Israel, and even made his son pass through the fire according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel. Okay, imagine that's your dad. Ahaz is your dad. What's it like to grow up in Ahaz's house? And that's what Hezekiah did. He grew up in Ahaz's house. And he's thinking, Dad loved idols so much that he sacrificed my brother to one. How'd you like to grow up in that house? That's Hezekiah. Then look in chapter 18 at Hezekiah. Somehow that boy, Hezekiah, grows up and decides, I want to serve God. Chapter 18 and verse 1. Now it came about in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, became king. And he was 29 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Abi, the son of Zechariah. He did right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done, meaning ancestor David. He removed the high places and broke down the sacred pillars and cut down the Asherah. He also broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the sons of Israel burned incense to it. And it was called Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among those who were before him. For he clung to the Lord. He did not depart from following him. but he kept his commandments, which the Lord had commanded Moses. Okay, so here's Hezekiah growing up in that household of Ahaz, and yet he decides, I'm going to worship God. And all the idols that his dad used to worship, he's breaking those things down. He's melting them down, crushing them up, whatever he did. He's destroying those things. You'd like to have Hezekiah as your dad, wouldn't you? And yet Hezekiah's son is Manasseh. And Manasseh decides, I'm going to be evil. Chapter 21, look at verse 1. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hephzibah. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abominations of the nations which the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he erected the altars of Baal and made an Asherah, as Ahab king of Israel had done, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. So here's Manasseh, and he's rebuilding the idols. Here's all the bad stuff that's gone. Now let's rebuild it. Let's turn back to sin. Now, there's a bright spot at the end of Manasseh's life where he does turn back to God, and that shows the grace of God. You can mess up your whole life, and at the end, he is sincere in his repentance, and he comes back to God, and the Lord is moved by his entreaty. Great story of God's grace here, but he's already had that influence on Ammon. Side point there, sometimes people say, I'll just do what I want my whole life. I'll repent on my deathbed, and I'll go to heaven in the end. Well, that's a bad plan for a lot of reasons. Number one, you never know when you're going to die. But secondly, what influence are you having on your kids all those years? And here's Ammon growing up in the household with his dad, worshiping idols all these decades before, at the end, thankfully, he does turn back to God. And then Ammon decides he's going to continue in that evil. You see in chapter 22 and verse 1, Josiah was 8 years old. I'm in the wrong one there. Chapter 21 and verse 19. Ammon was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 2 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Meshulameth, the daughter of Haraz of Jotbah. He did evil in the sight of the Lord as Manasseh his father had done, for he walked in all the way that his father had walked and served the idols that his father had served and worshiped them. Okay, and then Ammon's son Josiah, here again, if you're growing up in Ammon's house, and then Josiah said, I'm going to be righteous. Chapter 22 and verse 1. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jedidiah, the daughter of Adiah of Boskath. He did right in the sight of the Lord, walked in all the ways of his father David, nor did he turn aside to the right or to the left. In chapter 23 and in verse 25, before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. And then Josiah's sons, the next two are both Josiah's sons, Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim. You can read in those verses, they turned away from the Lord. Here we have, just look how it's back and forth among these guys. They're growing up, some of them in evil households, some of them in righteous households, but it's up to them to decide, am I going to be faithful or not? So given those examples, what advice could we give to a person who's blessed with a godly family? Should we say, you got it made? I mean, your ticket to heaven is pretty much punched. You grew up with these godly parents, they brought you to church all the time, you're just leaps and bounds ahead of everybody else. Not necessarily. There's advantages there, and you ought to be thankful that your parents taught you what they did and got you in some habits that are going to be helpful to you, but your faith is your choice. You don't just soak it up from mom and dad or grandma and grandpa or whoever. Sadly, there's plenty of Bible examples of people who had everything going for them, and then they just threw it away. Why? Because it's your own choice. My faith, or lack thereof, is my choice. I've got to read my Bible. I've got to decide if it's true or not. I've got to obey it. Now, what's the other side of the coin? What advice would we give to somebody who grew up in an evil family? They've inherited a mess. They grew up learning nothing about righteousness and everything about how to sin. They've never been to a church service before, but they know how to get drunk and they know how to do this and that. What about that kind of kid? Grew up in that kind of a family. What do we say to them? Well, your hope is lost. You'll never amount to anything spiritually. Not necessarily. You might be like one of these who grew up and your dad sacrificed your brother to an idol, and yet you decide, maybe because of that, I'm going to be righteous. I'm not going to live that kind of life. I don't want that kind of mess in my life. I want to turn to him. There's hope there, and it depends on each one of us. Like countless others in the Bible, you can turn to God. You can glorify God in the way that you live your life. and you can go to heaven in the end. You can develop that godly attitude. You can learn what you need to learn. You can grow, and you can do right. Is it going to be hard? Yeah. Living for God is hard in the sense of turning away from temptation when the devil is very successful at tempting us. But you know, a lot of times first-generation Christians have some extra zeal there that people who grew up in the pew just don't have. There's an appreciation there that things are not taken for granted, and there's some zeal and some energy there that others don't have. But the point is, you are in control. It's your choice. Don't blame your parents. You might have come from a life that was horrible. Maybe they abused you. Maybe they taught you how to sin. Maybe there's horrible things that happened to you. And I am sorry that happened to you. But you can move past that. There's a Father who loves you, who will never treat you like that. He will never stop loving you. He will always give you grace when you turn to Him. And He wants to live with you forever. You can move past your earthly parents, however bad that was. If they sacrificed your brother and sister to idols, you can move past that and serve Him. He wants to be your Father forever in eternity. You know, Ezekiel 18 talks about that. The son who decided to be righteous, even though the father was wicked, he will not die for his father's iniquity. He will surely live. And so the period of the divided kingdom was a time of turmoil. It was a time of sin. It was a mostly evil period in the history of Israel. But there were a few bright spots in there, enough to show us that God preserves our power of choice, even in the worst of circumstances. And that perfectly harmonizes with the rest of the Bible. People could live in first century Corinth and flee idolatry. People could live in Thessalonica and be pure. People can live in 21st century Brazos Valley and stand with Christ. It's our choice. Let these folks be an example and encouragement to us. Can we help you this morning in a spiritual way? If so, please come forward while we stand and sing to encourage you.